As I found, okay, good. Shout out to all of my friends in Australia. You're all coping in the heat wave in your various places, hopefully. So yeah, we're I think it must have been 40 in Parramatta today, close to. Yeah. 44 in the car. So anyway, I'm Bande Sujato. Welcome everyone, and we are here to do some chanting, do some meditation, some Dhamma talk. And I'd like to begin with acknowledging the Burrumadigal people of the Darug Nation upon whose land we sit. And we pay our respects to them, and we remember at this days of 40 degrees in a concrete city, we remember their wisdom of living among the nice cool trees, which would have been much nicer. And they wouldn't have to have aircon to keep cool. But anyway, you know, they say that when the white people first arrived in Sydney, that the trees, it was like a parkland, and the trees were so big that you could just ride your horses around and ride your horses under the trees and so on. And so we tend to think sometimes like the land around here may be scrubby or something like that, but that's just because that's what's left. Yeah, anyway. Okay, let us begin by reciting the words of homage to the Triple Gem. Tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami, Dhammam saranam gacchami, Sangham saranam gacchami, Dutiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami, Dutiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami, Dutiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami, Tatiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami, Tatiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami, Tatiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami. Itipiso Bhagava Arahaṃ Sammasambuddho Vijjacarana Sampanno Sugato Lokavidu Anuttaro Purisa Dhamma Sarathi Sattha Deva Manusanam Buddho Bhagavati Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Sandhitiko Akariko Ehipasiko Opanayiko Pachatam Veditabo Vinyuhiti Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ujjupatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Nyayapatipanno Bhagavato
Savaka Sangho Samichi Patipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yaridam Chattari Purisayuga Ni Atta Purisa Pungala Esa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ahuneyo Pahuneyo Dakhineyo Anjali Karaniyo Anuttaram Punyaketa Lokasati.
Good. How are we going online? Do we still have audio? Yeah? Still have audio. Okay, let me know if there's a problem. My computer said that there was a bug, something. Not sure what's going on. Hey, Eddie. All right, so we're here in the aircon, cooling our outsides. Why don't we do some meditation and cool our insides as well? So we know that the Buddha's name for his highest state, the summum bonum in Buddhism, is Nibbana, the going out of the flame. Obviously, a terminology developed in a hot country. And if the Buddha had been born in Norway, he probably would have used a different image, one suspects. But anyway, very apt for those of us suffering through a heat wave in Sydney and in Australia today. So one of the insights that the Buddha had was that he talked about these things called sankharas. Okay? Sankharas literally meaning energies or forces or activities. And from a Buddhist point of view, everything is a sankhara. Okay? I'm a sankhara, you're a sankhara, that seat is a sankhara. This building, everything is a sankhara. Everything in the world is a sankhara. The only thing that isn't is Nibbana. So that means that everything is active. Everything is moving. Any stasis that we observe is really just because we're not looking closely enough. Or for long enough, perhaps. And so the movement and instability of these sankharas, these energies or forces or activities, in a way can be understood as creating heat, like creating a kind of friction, through friction, creating a kind of heat. Everything is moving all the time. And we experience that in our minds because we experience a level of instability and disturbance at any point in the mind. Now, this is a very subtle point about Buddhism. So the Buddha, when the Buddha was talking about suffering, talking about overcoming suffering. Yes, he meant overcoming grief and loss and anxiety and all of those kinds of things. But he also meant that even when there is no grief, even when there's no anxiety, even when you're happy and peaceful, there's still a level at which that sankhara, that activity, that kind of disturbance. Getting a couple of feedback from people that the microphone is quiet. Let me just double check my settings here. I don't think I've changed anything. Microphones. Okay, how's that? We're good? Okay, very good. So that was the problem. Thank you for that, Santi. So that looks like that was the problem. For some reason, it was giving the laptop mic rather than the... G'day, Dan. So it was either switching over to that mic that solved the problem, or just Dan came and just everything. Everything just sort of worked. Thanks for that, mate. And now we can turn the aircon on. What do you reckon? Let's do it. Yep. You know, I think that, you know, these days people think that artificial intelligence is going to take the world over and so on. But honestly, I think that what's going to happen is you're going to have like one AI that's going to call up the other AI over Zoom, and they're going to go, can you hear me? Is your mic on? Like, are we launching the nukes today or is that tomorrow? Anyway, moving along. So sorry about that interruption. But okay, so back to the topic. So the topic of sankharas and activity. So the opposite of that sankhara, the opposite of that activity, is nibbana, which is the going out, the peacefulness, the quenching. Now, that has a number of implications.
Ling. Can I actually clarify, is it sankhara and la in Thai call sankhara?
In la they call sankhan. Sankhan, yeah, or in Thai that Sankhan is saying, yeah. But it doesn't necessarily have exactly the same meaning. Yeah. I mean, Sankhan often means body, is that right? Yeah, so. Okay, so where were we? Right, so this guides the Buddha's whole approach to meditation. All right? The idea that what is creating that suffering, what's creating the disturbance, is these activities. So what brings peace is when these activities come to an end. This is a very fundamental property of all of the Buddha's teachings. So for example, of a different approach, so somebody who was, let's say, coming from a theological point of view might say, well, they want to meditate so that they can come closer to God. And through coming closer to God, then they'll realize the peace because the presence of God will bring that peace to them. And so that's like a completely different sort of metaphysic in how you're approaching meditation. So from a Buddhist point of view, each stage in our meditation is about the cessation of sankharas. Buddha called the progress of meditation anupubba nirodha, gradual cessation. Gradual cessation. Now, the good news is that what that means is that these sankharas are impermanent. Every experience you have, every feeling in your body, every bit of energy that you have, every sound, every thought, every memory, everything you've ever experienced or known in this life or other lifetimes, in any way, manner, shape or form, all of those things are impermanent and they will come to an end. And that means that every suffering that you've ever experienced will come to an end. And you can be like super lazy and not do anything about it. And it's just going to come to an end. And a lot of people these days are like, oh, you want to overcome this trouble, you've got to do the work. I'm like, okay, you can do the work, that's fine. But actually these things are impermanent. Now, the bad news is that in Buddhism, time is very long. Okay? So it'll come to an end, but it might be a while. Okay? Like billions of eons, perhaps. Okay? And that's especially the case when it comes to like reinforcing behaviors, right? This is a kind of the thing. It's not so much like the things that have, like if we have suffering because of something we've done in the past or something we've experienced or whatever, then that's one form of suffering. But when it gets really bad is when we do that. We re-experience it, or we keep, let's say we keep remembering a traumatic event, or we keep going over in our mind, like if we get angry at someone, right? It's natural to get angry at people from time to time, but then when you keep on bringing that up in your mind and keep on going over it and over it, and then that's when you keep that fresh, that's what makes it really powerful and makes it alive. So that's how these sankharas work. They continually fuel on each other and build this kind of mass of unstable and disturbing phenomena. So we can, what that suggests is that if we simply don't add to the fire, it will burn itself out. Yeah? That's the good news. If you don't add to the fire, everything will stop. And that's why in Buddhism we focus, the main focus in meditation is on stopping things. Now that's not to say that there isn't a place for understanding and dealing with things, because sometimes when we get caught into those ruts of thought or of emotion or of memory or whatever, then it can be helpful to go in and figure that out, work it out, and try to make sure that your mind, you know, doesn't keep perpetuating those patterns. But that's not like our starting point. Our starting point is to just let things settle, right? And so when we come to meditate, the peace in the mind doesn't come from the Buddha, doesn't come from the meditation technique, it doesn't come from your particular brilliance and genius, it doesn't come from some divine force or anything like that, it comes because sankharas are coming to an end. Because the things that are creating distress are stilling. And those energies and those activities are gradually fading away. So, I'll give you a brief story from my friend Giles told me years ago, and he used to teach kids who had mental and psychological issues at Rivendell's facility in Sydney. And there was one kid who used to go there who could never eat. He was suffered from a lot of insomnia. He had a lot of anxiety and so on. He couldn't sleep. And so he was on this medication to help him to sleep and so on. It was a terrible thing for a young boy to be like that. Anyway, one day Giles managed to, you know, sit beside him and do a guided meditation. And so he sat with him and just, you know, watching your breath and just a simple guided meditation. And this kid fell into this really deep sleep. He was able to relax and sleep without medication for the first time in years. And when he woke up afterwards, Giles said, have a good sleep. He said, oh, you know, he's felt better than he has done in years. So the next day, Giles says to him, oh, you know, remember that relaxation we did yesterday? Do you want to do that again? He said, no, I don't think so. Why? Because it's who he is. Right? Because you become attached to that idea, oh, I'm the one who suffers this. And sometimes you're not ready to let go of that, even though it's suffering. Yeah? It takes time. It takes time to do this. And so we do this all the time in our meditation. We will be sitting there and thinking all of these nasty thoughts about someone. Right? And we're not ready quite to let go of those nasty thoughts, because that's kind of who we are. Right? We're the one who defines ourselves in opposition to that other person. Right? This is how the mind works. So this is where the quality of faith comes in. Ah, faith, so important. Faith in the idea that when sankharas come to an end, when activities, forces, movements, phenomena, when all of those things come to an end, it's peaceful. It's nice. Yeah? So when we're meditating, we experience this over and over again. When we experience like an energy in your body, a tension which might dissipate, or a mood that you're holding on to maybe will go, or like an obsessive train of thought that you have and you're able to let go of it. And we'll experience these things, honestly, pretty much every time we meditate. We'll experience the breath, you know, being more ragged, more strong when we begin to meditate, and then becoming more soft and more silky as we proceed. So all of these are different manifestations of that idea of the quelling and the stilling of sankharas. But despite that, we still get attached to them, right? You might have let go of an angry thought 100 times in meditation, 1,000 times in meditation, but then the next one that comes up is still kind of enticing. You still kind of, ooh, just this one. Right? And so this is why that needs to be that continual training. The most important thing in doing that training well and doing it successfully is consistency. It's not doing anything outrageous. It's not about making yourself sit all night or doing the right method or doing any of these kinds of things. It's just being consistent. If you can consistently recognize that these unwholesome thoughts are unwholesome and let go of them, you'll find that your mind changes its behavior quite quickly. It doesn't take too long if you're working with your mind in the right way. And so this is the good news, that we don't necessarily have to wait for the entirety of samsara or whatever, but we can experience so much progress in this just in a single meditation, or in developing meditation for a few months or a few years, and we can see those meaningful differences starting to happen. So let's do some mindfulness of breathing meditation. So sitting quietly. Letting your mind settle into your body. Keeping awareness settled into your body. And as we sit there quietly, gently let the breath come in, breath going out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in. Mindfully breathing out. Letting the calm of the breath settle through your body, stilling and quelling. All of those thoughts, all of those perceptions, all of those feelings, all of those memories, all of those desires, fears, let the breath calm them down. Let them come to peace. Coming near to the end of the meditation, I want you to bring your awareness back into the senses, the sounds around you, the touch of cloth on your skin, and I want you to just reflect back over how the meditation went, inquiring into cause and effect. What just happened? How did my mind change? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu. Sadhu. Okay, very good. So let's take a bit of a break, and I'll see you back in about 5 minutes. Remind me if I forget. Okay, we're back. I think most people online are still coming back. Good. How's it going, Mike? You going good? Justin, how's things? All right. Very good. Martina, how's life over in Vienna? Cold. Right. Yeah, it's been freezing, hasn't it? Yeah. Yes, we had an English monk visiting us here. He's got to go back to England in a couple of days, so he'll be bouncing between the two extremes. Okay, so before we get started with the Dhamma talk, and just so I don't forget, we are coming up to Christmas and New Year. And I'm going to be teaching a retreat. Hopefully some of you will be at the retreat over Christmas New Year. If you're not booked yet, then book. We're going to have a pause for these Dhamma talks, both the Dhamma talks here and at Crow's Nest for this period of time, okay? So check the Lokanta website, but I'll just give you advanced warning of this. Next week, last one, okay? Because then the week after that we'll be starting the retreat. Yeah. Yes. Next week, last talk. Next week will be the last Harris Park talk until the 19th of January, I think. So going away for a couple of weeks for the retreat, and then I'm taking a couple of weeks holiday. Who approves that? You know who approved that? You know who gave permission for my holiday? My good karma. Yes. Stamped and approved by my own good karma. I deserve a few weeks off. Okay, so that's on the monastery website. I'll just put the website URL in the chat for those of you who are not aware. Just finding the dates on the website now. So, pausing a minute ago. That's right. Dhamma talks, Christmas pause. So we'll start again on the 19th of January. Okay, so we're back here at Harris Park on the 19th of January. Next week, last one, then 19th of January, start up again. Crow's Nest, the last talk will be at the 21st of December. So that's the Wednesday nights at Crow's Nest. And we'll start again, I think, on the 24th of January, but that's not entirely finalized. We need to hear back from Ayakarunika about what she wants to do there as well. So might be starting a little bit earlier, but that's the latest date. It might be the week earlier. So that's the crow's nest. But so for Harris Park, next week is the last week. Okay. And, of course, tomorrow we have our book launch at the Sydney State Library. So please come along, and that's starting at 2 o'clock if you're able to make it. Sorry? It's a hybrid event, yes. So you can also join online if you want to stay cool in the aircon, which sounds like I'm thinking about Joyce joining online tomorrow. But anyway, no, I'll definitely be there. But it's going to be really hot tomorrow. Yeah, it's going to be about 40. They're saying so. Yeah. Anyway. Okay, so for tonight's talk, I'd like to expand on that theme of sankharas I was talking about before, and discuss it more from a few different angles, I guess. Okay, so sankharas, activity, motion, very kind of Einsteinian in a way, right? Einstein's E equals mc squared, right? Everything in the universe is energy, actually. So you can, in a way, kind of convert what we think of as static things, okay? Right? Matter can be converted to energy, right? And but one of the interesting things in Einstein's formula, E equals mc squared, is the c squared, right? The speed of light squared. So do you know how fast the speed of light is? Yeah, it's like super fast. So if I turn the light on there and I try to run away from it very quickly, no way that I'm going to go faster than the speed of light, okay? It's like super duper fast. Mike can post the exact details in the chat if he feels so inclined. But anyway, it's like super duper fast. And so Einstein, they managed to measure it, like they've measured it with a huge degree of precision, actually. When what the physicists do is pretty amazing. And it's kind of verified a lot of the things that Einstein was positing purely on a theoretical basis, were since things like the light bending around stars and these kinds of things has since been proven by experimental observations. So it's not just the speed of light, but it's the speed of light squared, the speed of light times the speed of light. Okay? That's just so fast that, like, whatever, I don't care if you're driving like the fastest Tesla or something, there's no way you're getting even close to that, okay? This is like incredibly fast. So what that means is that in a tiny, 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 tiny bit of matter, static stuff, okay, when you convert that static stuff to dynamic stuff, it's incredible the amount of energy that's created. That's, of course, where you get atomic bombs and all of that stuff, right? That's why they're so powerful. But that's not just atomic bombs, that's stars, that's the sun. That's what's going on in the sun. That's why the sun is releasing all of this energy. A tiny, tiny bit of that static stuff, when it's converted to dynamic stuff, it is an incredible thing. Another way of thinking about it is you can think that matter is like if you get energy, okay, and you put it into like a press and you like screw it down and compress it and compress it and compress it and compress it, then like matter is like super compressed energy. Yeah. And sort of locked into a relatively static form. So we kind of think of matter as being something which is static, right? We think that, tables last, and we think that water sort of lasts. And they do, and you can find matter that can be billions of years old. There are rocks that are billions of years old, and it's a long time, and it's pretty stable. But actually, that will all come to an end, whether it comes in that way, whether there's a big bang or a big crunch or whatever. We don't really know the kind of big, in the long term, what's going to happen in the universe. But all of those forms of matter ultimately are unstable, and they transform. So the Buddha's teachings on sankhara is very similar. And so the Buddha's teachings on sankharas is that those things that you take to be stable, okay, your personality, who you are, what you believe, what you like, right? All of these things are just constructs. They're things that we have built out of habit and repetition, out of desire, out of memory, out of identification. And we create this sense of the world that we live in. And we think that this world that we live in is kind of static. Now, again, it's not entirely untrue. Obviously, there are things that you can see that are quite static in people's lives. So you can look back at how you were when you were a kid, and you can often see, oh, you know, a lot of the same personality traits. You know, you're still, when you're an adult, you know, you still, you know, whatever, like the same things or something like that. And like these days in psychology and neuroscience, they like to talk a lot about neuroplasticity. Like, so they say that your brain can rewire itself to adapt. Like as you use your brain, it will rewire, rechange itself, which is true. But it's also true to say that brains don't actually rewire themselves all that much. Brains most of the time stay fairly stable. This is why when they kind of discovered neuroplasticity, it was a big deal, because actually brain structure is quite static, and before that they thought it didn't really change. And then they said, no, it can change. So yes, it can change, but it doesn't actually change a lot. You know, it's gradually changing, right? So it's gradually changing little bit by little bit through our life. But it's not like you can just sort of suddenly reconfigure your brain by learning to think in a different way. Right? It's not that dramatic. So it's the same thing with your mind. Like your mind is these energies which are solidified, okay, into these structures. And look, it's only an analogy. I'm not saying it's the same thing, but if you think about it in an analogy with Einstein's theory of relativity, you think about like how much energy has been locked up into these structures. We're talking the speed of light squared amount of energy is locked up into these structures. Yeah? And that has happened. Again, according to Buddhism, our consciousness is an ongoing stream or an ongoing flow of energy. And because that ongoing flow or stream of energy has been going for a long time, then that conditioning has been working for a long time. And so the things that we find might be persistent in our behaviors and our personality and our views and so on in this lifetime, right, are also going to go back a long way before that, most likely. Yeah, and that's why they become so fixed, such sort of solid structures. Yeah? So like if I look back in my life, you know, I can see when I was a kid, I already had an excellent sense of humor. And and this is like a persistent pattern that I... I'm not really kidding. But anyway, I'm only mostly kidding. But anyway, so, and you can see that, and you think, who would I be, right? I mean, that's a good example, right? Who would you be without being able to laugh, without being able to crack a joke, right? We don't really think about it too much. There's a science fiction story that I read many years ago that was about that. And it was done a research, an AI or something like that was doing research into, like, you know, what's the... why do we have a sense of humor, right? And so they're doing all of these things, and they ultimately found out the reason we have a sense of humor was because humanity was created by aliens as an experiment to test out what having a sense of humor would be like. And as soon as we discovered that, then that ruined the experiment, so the sense of humor just got switched off. One of the most disappointing scientific findings ever, right? So is it just gone? And they're just like, oh, nothing's funny anymore. Yeah. But like these stories are ways of dramatizing. They're always, any alien story in Buddhism is always about what does humanity mean? Sorry, any alien story in science fiction is always about what is humanity about? Like, what are we as human beings? And that's one of the things it's pointing to, is that sense of humor is part of who we are as human beings. And that tends to remain, not the same necessarily, but it tends to have a persistence to it. So one of the things in Buddhism is that, of course, the Buddha was responding to a particular context. And in the context that Buddha was responding to, everybody was about permanence, okay? The Brahmins were all about you have an Atman, it's eternal, it's going to last forever. The Jains were all like you have this Jiva, which is like this individual soul. It's like a crystalline essence of reality. It's going to be there forever and so on. And so most, not all, but most of the philosophers and so on at the time of the Buddha were looking for some kind of eternal essence, something that would be who we are, that would last forever. And so the Buddha, being a killjoy, comes along and says, no, there isn't any such thing, right? You're looking for something that doesn't exist. All of these things are in fact impermanent. And so this is why he emphasized impermanence a lot in his teachings. But of course, then that then creates a problem, because when you talk about impermanence and change all the time, how do you account for continuity? Okay? And this is why I mentioned that thing with neuroplasticity. Like, it's not just the case that you just change everything about your brain. You can gradually tweak it and evolve it and move it. But it isn't the case that things are just completely different all the time. Actually, things run in patterns, many of which go for a long, long time, and often in very tedious ways, you know? And you look in society and you look in history and you see, you know, we keep making the same mistakes again and again and again. When are we going to learn, yeah? As Bob Dylan said, right? How many roads must we walk down? How many times are we going to think those negative thoughts? How many times are we going to get trapped into that bad mood? How many times are we going to tell ourselves a story about what a victim that we are and how everybody else is mean to us, right? How many times are we going to keep on going on with these kinds of toxic internalized narratives and patterns and dysfunctional behaviors? And the answer, of course, is as long as you want to. Yeah, these things are ultimately driven by desire. That's why we do these things. It's driven by desire. So those things will keep on going and they'll keep on perpetuating themselves. So we have to have some way of accounting for continuity in Buddhism. And this was one of the major points of controversy in the early Buddhist schools. I'm talking about 200 to 400 years after the Buddha. And there was these kind of different schools that would have different arguments about how we can account for the continuity of things. So one very famous school was called the Sarvastivada school. And the Sarvastivadins, they've kind of disappeared today, although a lot of their texts still remain, and they're still studied in especially Tibet and China. But the Sarvastivadins had this kind of quite interesting and quite subtle take on what impermanence meant. So Sarvastivadin said essentially that the past, future and present all exist. That's what Sarvasti means. Sarvang Asti, everything exists. Okay? But that word Asti or Ati in Pali means kind of existence in a kind of metaphysical sense. Okay? They kind of somehow are. All right? And they account for impermanence by saying that the present is what is active. Right? Again, there are different ways of formulating this, but this is the basic idea, that the past, present, and future kind of all are, in a sense, but only the present is actually functioning. It's a little bit like if you have a book. Yeah? You have a book. All of the words in that book, in some sense, are, but only when you open a page and read a bit, only those words that you're actually reading are actually having any effect. Yeah? So this is something like that Sarvastivadin idea. It's a kind of interesting idea, kind of curious idea of a way of thinking about impermanence. Now, one can criticize that. I personally don't believe that idea is correct. You could criticize it from a number of points of view. You could say, well, it's not really, if it always exists, it's not really impermanent. And I think that would be kind of a classical Theravada critique of that. You could also critique it from Occam's razor point of view. Right? Occam's razor, thou shalt not multiply entities unnecessarily. So you've just suddenly created all of this, all of the entities in the past and the future, which now exist. It's a lot. Like, it's a lot of stuff. And if you're positing that still exists, and you, when you don't really have much evidence for the existence of those things, so you'd need like a strong evidence to prove that they exist. So this is one of the ways that the Buddhist schools conceived of that past, present and future. Now, the Theravadan point of view, or the Mahavihara point of view, was somewhat different. So the Mahavihara point of view instead emphasized conditionality. So the things that are in the past cease, they come to an end, they're gone completely. Things in the future don't exist at all. Yeah? There's nothing there, right? There's ontological void, only the present exists. Okay? So, but obviously, since existence is not just a pile of sand, it's not just a bunch of discrete and unrelated things, what explains the continuity is causality. The past causes the present causes the future. So this is a classical Theravada point of view, and it's probably the point of view you'll hear most of the time explained from a Buddhist point of view. So under this kind of model, what this shows is that that things in the past, that we can understand like a flow or kind of a movement from the past to the present to the future, but one that is not absolute and fixed. So there's causality and a conditionality, which means that we can observe persistent and repeating patterns. Okay, this is one of the important things to bear in mind. We can observe patterns. Now, if you've meditated, you know what I mean. When you meditate, things tend to follow similar patterns. When you sit down to meditate, your body feels maybe a bit disturbed or a bit tense, you know, and you maybe have to adjust your shoulders or your posture, and then you're sitting there and then there's thoughts come in your mind, and those thoughts tend to be, for the most part, fairly familiar, right? Going over the same ground, things we've been thinking of before. Rarely do you sit down to meditate and immediately have an unprecedented stroke of insight of something you've never thought of before. I mean, it can happen, but most of the time, you're kind of just variations of the kinds of things you thought before. And then, you know, trying to be aware of your breath, and then that pattern where you're aware of your breath a bit, and then mind drifts off, and then you go to lose it, and then you come back to it. And so these are like the patterns that you tend to observe most of the time in meditation. Sometimes not, of course. Sometimes it'll be very different. So these observing of patterns is where we're starting to learn about this conditionality and about this process of change and how it works. And so it's important to not fall into an absolutist approach when thinking about this, right? If each time you meditate, if you can't learn from your meditation, right, then you're going to keep on making the same mistakes again and again. And this is what I see a lot in meditators. Meditators a lot of the times keep on making the same mistakes again and again. Why? Because they've heard someone's idea about what meditation is. They've read a book. They've heard a talk. They've read a sutta, and it says do this. They think that's what that means, and they go and they do it. And then it's bad and it doesn't work, but they think that's what meditation is. So you keep on doing it, and you think, oh, well, it must be me. There's something wrong with me that it doesn't work. Yeah? And so you're continuing to repeat mistakes because you have this idea in your head about what you think meditation is supposed to be. So this is kind of one fallacy if you're not actually going to learn from it. Yeah? But then, you know, you can also fall into a fallacy of that's the fallacy of like failing to reflect on your meditation. But you can also fall into a fallacy of being like, in a way, like too open in your meditation, like treating each meditation as just, you know, just whatever comes up. This is what, again, a lot of people say to me. They meditate, oh, it's just, you know, how do you meditate? And they say, oh, I just sit and then just whatever comes up. Okay, so. All right, fine. I mean, I understand it's a bit more than that because it's trying to be mindful of things that are coming up, right? So it's a bit more than that. But still, then there's a kind of an overly lax approach. So either too strict or too lax can be the faults that meditators fall into. So we should have a certain degree of discipline in our meditation, a certain degree of focus. We sit down to meditate, we know how we're going to meditate, and we undertake that meditation and then proceed. If we're going to be doing breath meditation, we begin, and we are mindful of our breathing. And at that time, you're not doing recollection of the Buddha, you're not doing body scanning, you're not doing metta meditation, you're not doing any of those other meditations, all of which are perfectly good, but they're not what you're doing right now. Okay? So you have to have that resolution which will give you that continuity. At the same time, though, if you have too much of a fixed idea of what that meditation is going to be like, then you won't be open to the spontaneity of experience. Right? You won't know how your different moods are affecting the meditation, how the feeling around you is affecting it, how the time, how any of these things will change what's happening in your meditation. So neither completely loose and or completely fixed, but firm but flexible in our approach to meditation. All right. So these sankharas, which are conditioning our behaviors, right, in a way applies to everything. And what I've been talking about so far applies to, you know, all the phenomena and so on that's happening. However, it's interesting to note that particular use of sankhara is fairly rare in the suttas. You find it, but only in a few places. Most of the time, the Buddha used sankhara in a more limited sense to talk about the volition and volitional choices that you make. Now, these two meanings are related because it is through those choices, right? When we say, we can say a choice or a volition, literally it means something like a constructive activity, all right? Through that activity of construction that we make, we build this world of sankharas, of conditioned phenomenon in which we live. Right? So that act, those acts of will, those choices, are the primary thing that determine what kind of world that we live in. Right? This is a very subtle and very powerful point. Think about how your day goes, right? First act of will is, am I going to get out of bed in the morning? Yes or no, maybe 50-50, okay? And that's going to completely determine the rest of your day, right? I mean, if you decide I'm just going to stay here, you're going to have a very different day. Yeah? Maybe you're going to get sacked. You know, that might change the entire course of your life, right? Just that one little choice. But when you have that choice in your mind, like when you're lying in bed, you're sleepy, oh, I don't have to get up and so on, it seems quite reasonable that you might just want to stay in bed. I mean, you know that you're not going to, right? But at that time, it's like, oh, maybe. And it's such a small thing, that act of volition that gets you up in the morning. Yeah, that act of volition that makes you have breakfast, that gets you out of the house, that gets you doing things. We normally don't even pay attention to it. We're just doing one thing after another. But there's always this kind of volition, sankhara, which is making us choose what are we going to do. Yeah? And it's pushing us in one direction or another. And that shapes the entire life that we have. What direction do we look at? What food do we eat? What activities do we do? What do we say? All of those things are shaped by our sankharas, which are pointing our mind in one direction and building up the world, literally building up the world that we live in. Yeah? So this is how the sankharas work. So when we're in meditation, in a way, what we do is we come back inwards and we start to unwind that process of sankharas so that they're no longer kind of hidden by things, right? You kind of expose them because you're not following them. Yeah. So rather than normally you might be like, oh, I need a coffee, I'll go and grab a coffee, and you don't really think about it, you know? You're just there and you have the coffee. You don't notice the volition. When you're in meditation, you start to expose that by not acting out on it, right? Even just very simple things. You're sitting there and thinking, oh, I've got an itch. Right? And you all know what I mean, right? You're there and you're like, oh, I should scratch it. No, I shouldn't scratch it. I'm not going to. And then can you lose mindfulness for just a minute and suddenly you're scratching, right? And that's that sankhara. You can feel that energy. Yeah? So this is what we're doing in meditation. We're quelling those sankharas and we're exposing them by not reacting to all of them. So you start to learn, oh, this is how that works. Yeah? And you begin to realize how every little detail of our life is shaped by these things. Every little detail, every direction we look in, every breath we take, every word that we speak is shaped in some way by our volitions. And so this starts to teach us that we're not the victims of our life. This is really important. We're not the victims of our life. Like, stuff happens to us, and maybe terrible stuff, yeah? You know, and, you know, maybe we are the victims in certain circumstances and so on, but that's not who we are. That's not what our life is. Our life isn't determined by what happens to us. Our life is determined by what we do about it, how you respond to it. And so these sankharas are how we're responding to things. Now, of all of these sankharas, most of them, right, most of them are not, you know, most of them just come and go, and they're not particularly, they don't have particularly huge consequences, but some do. And those that have big consequences are the moral choices that we make, ethical choices, yeah? These are very consequential. Again, think about it, right? If you're trying to think of an example, if you decide, am I going to drink some coffee or some tea, that's not going to really affect you very much. You have some coffee, you have some tea, it's fine, whatever, it doesn't matter too much. But if you're walking down the road and you see somebody drinking what looks like a really nice coffee and you decide to mug them, beat them over the head and steal their coffee from them, okay? Anyone, that happened to anyone recently? No? Then that's going to have a huge effect on you, right? This is just kind of moral choices. And so the moral choices is the primary sense of what the Buddha was talking about by sankharas. The Buddha wasn't so interested in, like, you know, all of these sankharas make the world that we live in, but the Buddha wasn't that interested in, like, what colour you painted your walls or whatever. He was interested in the moral choices and the consequences that happened. This is what we call karma, right? So these sankharas create reality, they create the reality that we live in, that we subjectively experience. And those moral choices have an incredible potency to them. Again, just think about it. Think about how a single choice can send somebody down a whole lifetime. Yeah? Yeah? How you can destroy everything. Right, if you're a government official, maybe just one bribe that you accept, yeah, and that can destroy your whole life. Yeah, and so those moral choices have an incredible potency, much like the matter in Einstein's theory of relativity. So, in special theory of relativity, that matter times C squared equals energy. That's similar. Think about the mathematics that the Buddha talked about, right? If you do a bad deed, then you're going to get reborn in a bad destiny for millions or billions of years. Yeah? It's a similar kind of mathematics, right? That energy that's encapsulated in those moral choices has that incredible potency. So then this then has a number of kind of consequences, particularly consequences for meditation. So the Buddha's approach to meditation is that, well, first of all, we stop doing bad things and do good things. Okay, that's number one. Second thing is once we do good things, we then will refine those good things, simplify those good things, and ultimately even they will pass away. Even doing good things is another kind of sankhara. So ultimately we'll find a sense of peace, which is neither good nor bad. Yeah? So this is that progress that we take through. gradual cessation of sankharas. So in the process of mindfulness of breathing meditation, we are building on those foundations. We've ceased the sankharas, the worst sankharas of bad moral conduct. We've adopted those good sankharas of good moral conduct, and now we're seeking to meditate, and we're now looking not just at conduct, but at how our mind works. And we're starting to let go of those things that are harmful in the mind, and to develop those things that are beneficial, gradually, gradually, gradually. And you might have noticed that sort of Dhamma practice tends to be very fast at the beginning and then slow as it goes along. Also a bit kind of relativistic. This is a bit like the dilation of time in if you're in a spaceship approaching the speed of light, right? You can speed up to like 90% of the speed of light, no problems. And then as you get closer and closer and closer to it, mass gets heavier and you it's harder and harder to accelerate. A bit like that. Yeah? You remember doing that? Yeah. It's a common phenomenon, yeah. So, but the same thing, like you can feel when you start your meditation that you feel like you know, or even when you start Dhamma practice, you take precepts and so on, you can feel like it makes such a difference right away. Oh, you have some clarity around things. It's so nice to know that, look, these are your precepts, maybe you break them or whatever, but at least you know what you want to do and you can try better next time, you know? And it gives you so much clarity and joy to be able to do that, to practice and to do the things. And when you start to meditate, you really start to make some progress, you really start to get some clarity and so on. And then the longer that you do it, the slower the progress seems to be, yeah? Yeah? It's because we've done with all the surface stuff. Right? And now we're dealing with those more long-term structures, yeah? The more things that are ingrained, more things that are very deep level. So it takes time, yeah? So don't be disillusioned. Don't be disheartened. It's natural that should happen, yeah? Think about it's the same thing like learning any skill, you know? Like when I was a guitar player, you know, if you start guitar, you start to learn and you make good progress. After a couple of years, you can play some songs and do some pieces and things like that. And then after I've been playing guitar professionally for years and I was pretty good at it. And I was practicing like 6 hours a day. And you can look back and think, am I better than I was a year ago? Maybe. Maybe a bit better. You know, I can probably do a few things that I couldn't do a year ago. But you have to keep it up to be able to keep up to that level. So this is natural that this should happen. So don't be disillusioned. But what the most important thing that's happening is that as you're continuing, you are not building up and reinforcing those sankharas. Yeah? So even though those patterns in your mind, even though those tendencies and habits, all of those things might seem like they're just ingrained and entrenched and they'll be there forever, but so long as you're not reinforcing them, they will come to an end. Nothing you can do about that. They will come to an end. So be patient, take heart, don't be disillusioned. Yeah? You will find your way in the end. So this is my talk for today on sankharas. A couple of comments from online from Mike. Thanks. Light goes 30 centimeters in a nanosecond. That's 10 to the power of -9 seconds. Okay, so that's pretty fast. It is pretty fast. So I think the light from the sun, the light from the center from Hasanta, light from the center of the Milky Way would take 50,000 years to leave the galactic edge, and Aboriginal people have been here in Australia longer than that. Holy crap! I never thought of that. That's amazing, right? So light from the other side of the Milky Way is still arriving. Like, hang on, the sun that was shining on the Aboriginal people when they came to Australia, right, that light is now leaving the other side of the galaxy. Something like that. 6 minutes, like 6 minutes for the sunlight to get to Earth, which means that the sun could have exploded 6 minutes ago. And we wouldn't know it. Yes. Okay. So Sumana mentioned one day, I heard a teacher said that there are trillions of chitta in every mind moment. So the speed of chitta changing in every mind moment and speed of light, which one is faster? Can we do a math? Okay, so trillions of chitta in every, I'm not sure that that's, okay, so this is in reference to the theory of momentariness, the Kanavada, which of course we don't find in the suttas, but in the Theravada school and in most of the school, Indian schools of Buddhism, you have this idea that there is a sort of a minimal, almost like a quantum of time that's like the shortest possible amount of time. And so usually it says that there's like trillions of those that happen in every second or whatever. It's not really kind of measured, but just faster than anything else. And the basic idea is that that those mental events are ultimately faster than any physical events. So in Theravada, I think there's 17 chittas in any rupa. I think that's the equation. But someone can correct me if I'm wrong. It's been a long time since I've studied the Abhidhamma. So, but that's the basic idea. So the mind is faster than the speed of light. Can we do a math? Yeah, not really. I personally, I don't really believe the chitta, the Kanavada, but yeah, that's the way that it's been conventionally understood. Okay, Gillian says, some meditators say they can see successive mind moments. Would each moment then be a discrete sankhara? Okay, so again, just be careful not to mix up our terminology. So is each mind moment a discrete sankhara? If you by discrete sankhara you mean discrete conditioned phenomena, then yes. But if by sankhara do we mean like an act of will, so then that would be one of the mental phenomena that accompanies each mind moment. Okay, so the mind moment is not volition. It's volition is part of the mind moment, but each mind moment is a conditioned phenomenon. That's true. Okay. Yes. Something like that. No. Each chitta has. The chitta witti. So 17 chittas in every chitta witti, right? And I think that isn't the one chitta witti is like the same time as one rupa. I may be wrong on that. Yeah. So chitta witti is like one sort of active a full cognitive process, which consists of 17 times the mind. Anyway, look, I'm not going to go into it. The first 17 chittas in the terms of the period of time. Yeah, this was literally the first lesson that I ever had in Buddhism in Thailand. Yeah, the monk went up to the board, blackboard, draws 17 circles on it and says, this is your mind, and starts explaining it all. I'm like, wow, that's incredible. So anyway. All right, Dan.
Is there a sense that like you're talking about now being existing?
Yeah.
I just want to check because my kind of understanding of like instead of just talking those terms of existing and non existing is kind of like the side of the brain that you're on. And so like the idea that like is there an idea where like essentially we should turn off the world by producing sankhara, like the world can disappear by us calming sankhara.
Right.
Literally.
Right.
Literally.
Well, our world can. I mean, the world out there keeps going. The world out there keeps, that doesn't care. They'll just say there's this kind of weird person that's just not moving.
It's weird.
Yeah. Right.
It's like a situation where I think this might be a situation where like I heard it was kind of Buddhist and like calm, but it wasn't. It was just everything's calmed down and light's gone and it comes back.
Right.
It's not the bottom, it's not John.
Right.
But what they do is they use that to determine what the sankhara was like in this life.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Look, I don't want to get too much into the theoretical discussion of the Abhidhamma mind moment theory, which would take some time. But you're talking about what they call Bhavanga. Bhavanga is another actual, is actually another part of the Theravadin answer to the question of continuity. Right? So that basically, Bhavanga is the answer to the question, like, what happens when your mind isn't working? Right? So then there is this Bhavanga chitta, which is purely a functional chitta that just goes one after the other while your mind isn't actually doing anything. Yeah, so that's what Bhavanga is. It really just performs a function to glue your mind together. It doesn't really do anything except it does transfer causality. So it's like billiard balls. So if you have like a line of billiard balls there, you can say, well, you know, if they're all together, you can hit this one and then this one will go off. So these ones, in a sense, are not doing anything, except in a sense they're transferring that energy to the end. So that's a bit like Bhavanga. That doesn't actually move or do anything, but it just lets that end one go off. Again, I don't want to sort of get too much into the theory of this part because I don't really understand it that well, but anyway. Okay, so one last question from Melanie and Marion. What is vibhava? So vibhava is a Pali term, a technical term, which means the ending or annihilation of existence. So in Buddhism, so to understand vibhava, so the flip side of that is bhava, which means existence, but it means especially like the continuity of existence, the fact that we want to keep on living. So craving for bhava is the craving to want to keep on living in this life or in the next life. And vibhava is the flip side of that. This is a bit like what Freud talked about this as well. He said, you know, we have this death wish, which accompanies, you know, we want to live, and then we have this sort of flip side of it, which is like a death wish. So vibhava tanha, the craving for vibhava, is a bit like that, a craving for a death wish, or craving to end, or craving to cease things. And so these two are kind of two sides of the same coin. The Buddha said that if you follow that desire to end things, and obviously like an extreme form of that would be like a wish for suicide or something like that, but often it manifests subconsciously in more subtle forms. But the Buddha said that this was like a dog that's tied to a post and it wants to get away from the post, and so it keeps on running and running and running around in circles around the post. And the more it keeps on running around, it keeps on wrapping its leash onto the post and getting more and more tightly tied onto it. So this is what happens when we follow that vibhava tanha. So I hope that answered your question. Okay, let us finish. We have one more message for you before we go. And we have a special guest star for today. Ling. Come, Ling. She's going to give you a message.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you. I would like to acknowledge you.
For the folks online, yeah.
Hi, everybody. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land from the past, present, and emerging, and everybody who is actually here, and especially our beautiful teachers here, Bante Sujato, and everyone here who is actually the future Buddha. But of course, we actually have to walk. We have to make it happen. So today, I would like to share with you. But before that, let me introduce myself. I'm actually one of my many hats. I'm a SRE teacher. So I'm here. Someone have to help me. Special education diligent. Yeah, that's what Bhante. Did you hear what Bhante say? Now you can see how you know how I am. Then it will give you lots of confidence to be a better and a good SRE teachers. I'm here just to share with you, you know, how the classes actually run. We only have 30 minutes a week. And what happened is when you actually get into the class is that, you know, you actually have to do the roll calls and you have got the teachers sitting next to you. And what I do is that directly, I get them to do meditations, like what Bhante is actually doing here. The reason, I'll keep going. And then I actually will, get the kids to actually to do activities and sharing them with the books. You know, the book, I would bring children's book that I would like to teach them, like, for example, responsibility or good and bad, happy, you know, what is happy is, and things like that. So I would choose a book which is actually children's book where I can actually manage. You can actually see that I'm actually quite a simple-minded person. You know, complication is actually doesn't get me anywhere. So I choose something simple where I can actually share with the kids and also at the kids' levels. And all it is that after that, we actually ask the kid to raise any questions like what we actually have here. And then half an hour is actually done. But before that, you know, before the meditations, I always actually do the Ode to Tipo Gems. So we actually will sing Ode to Tipo Gems. Whatever it is, the SRE classes that is actually I'm running, it's fun. How can I say that? It's action, you know. It's and it's simple as well. Yeah. So what I'm actually here sharing SRE with you is that with what Bhante was actually saying that before that we actually have conversation previously. We really, really, really like to see everybody here. And Bhante said all his participants or his students are very, 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 very clever. All of them have highly, highly intelligent and highly educated. So, so you know, I believe that, you know, all I wanted to say here is to encourage everybody to go out there and, meditation and also put Buddhism in our real life practice where we can actually share with the kid, where we can make a difference, where we actually can step out there into the community, into the children's life. And these children are our futures. We need them, and how we actually, it's our responsibility as well. And it's only half an hour a week. And like I said, it's not hard. It's half an hour go so quickly. With Bhante has actually been teaching us for this many years. I think, I really, really encouraging you to put it into practice and to give it a go. And, you know, to make a difference in our community, in our society. Oh, yes. And there are trainings available. You don't have to actually to go out there in the cold. There is actually Buddhist councils actually give training. And also Nantian Temple also give trainings. And also there's a Vietnamese temples in Kapamata Way is also actually give trainings as well. I'm not going to give you the details, any more details, because you can actually just go in on online and get yourself trained. The most important thing is our heart and our will that we would like to actually to share. And another, one last thing I promise is that I actually felt sorry for Bhante that he have to answer all these complicated questions in my mind anyway. For me, if the children throw any questions to me and I have no idea, I would actually would tell them, I would put them in the on the floor, ask the other kids to actually to have respond to that questions that they may have. And at the end, I would say, I'll come back to you. Because, you know, Bhante is always actually here, right? If you have any question, we come back and we ask Bhante and we go back to the kids and we say, guess what? I got the answers from Bhante Sujato. This is the answer. Thank you so much, Satu, Satu, Satu. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Thank you.
So, thanks. Thanks, Ling. And so just encouraging people, especially people here in Sydney, if you do have some time, you're able to help, do some SRE teaching, it would be great. We're seriously lacking in volunteers. And there are a lot of kids in the Buddhist community in Sydney who don't have support and encouragement for any kind of Buddhist education. A lot of times you have kids who, for example, their parents don't speak any English or who don't have that background. Some kids do have access to Sunday school and to Buddhist training, so that's great if they can get it, but a lot of kids don't have that. And so in Sydney, the system is that for primary school, volunteers will go along and teach, like you're saying, half an hour a week. We call special religious education. You don't have to be an expert or you don't have to be super proficient, but you just have to have some kindness and some goodwill to share with people. If they do have the hard questions, then you can come and see me, for example. Like, do monks wear underwear, you know? So you can come to me and get that. That's what I was asked. When I went to this primary school in Adelaide, the number one question, that was what the most wanted to know. And the next one was, when you're eating from your bowl, have you ever had a toucan take your food from you? It's very specific, isn't it? It's very specific. Has a toucan ever taken the food from you? And I had to say, yes, that has exactly happened to me in Thailand. And there was these great hornbills, which are, what are they like? They're like one of these ibises or something, but with a big, even bigger thing. And they were really tame, and they used to hang around the sala when we would eat, and they just come and take food out of your bowl when you're eating. So I had to say to this kid, yes, that literally is a problem when you're a monk. Yeah. Anyway, so look, if you are interested and helping out in Sydney, and look, if you're not in Sydney, if you're somewhere else around the world, you know, have a look and see, maybe there might be a way that you can contribute there as well. I'm sure that there's something you can do. But don't feel like you don't know enough, and don't feel like, you know, you're not qualified, okay? Just a bit of kindness and a bit of wisdom and a bit of support will go a long way. So if you're interested, then please do reach out to us and we can pass you on to Ling, or you can reach out to the Buddhist Council and various people who will offer that support. Okay. Also, we have a Cabramatta Community Pindabat at Sunday at 9:30, right? Yes. I believe so. Yeah. So for those folks who are around in Sydney, in southwest Sydney and Cabramatta area, then Community Pindabat, which is usually huge, massive. Okay. What else? Sorry? Oh, good. Yeah, great. And so I'll be there, Venerable Brahmali. I think the Santi community will be there. I'm not sure who else will be there, but you'll be there. Sadhu, Sadhu. Aya Severa will be there. You're there every day anyway, aren't you? pretty much. Cameraman. This is special. You'll be there specially. Yeah. Okay. Thanks, everybody. See you again next week for the final Friday night for 2023.